You're listening to Down to Agribusiness with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll get the show on the road. Minister, MEPs, ladies and gentlemen, you're all very welcome here this morning. Delighted to say that, as the guys were just discussing, the Northern Alliance of the Farmers Journal is obviously very strong. We have our market specialist, Philem O'Neill from County Tyrone, our new renewables editor and ag tech specialist, Stephen Rowe from Donegal, his Donegal colleague, Anne Finnegan, also on the policy side. And we obviously slipped down the lines where somebody that many of you may not know, Lorcan Roach Kelly, has just joined us. He used to work for a little small organization, but decided it wasn't big enough. So he moved from Bloomberg to the Irish Farmers Journal. Lorcan, you're very welcome here. And this is probably your first official gig as our agribusiness editor. And I'm going to kick off with you, Lorcan, in terms of, to maybe for our audience here and for somebody that's, I suppose, new into the agricultural sphere, but very well rounded in terms of geopolitics and macro issues. What is going on in the world today? And I don't want a 10-page dossier. In a couple of minutes, what is happening in the world in terms of the whole geopolitical at a macro level? And bring it down then. What does this mean for this audience?
Okay, good morning. I suppose you didn't want to start today with any good news. You should start with me, so I'll be quick and brief. I think the big things happening in the world today, this is not new to anybody. There's inflation is pretty much running out of control in a lot of places. Europe, it's up 10% kind of across the board. We're seeing inflation in things that nobody can control on a personal level, like your energy prices are going up, your labor costs are going up, everything is going up for businesses. And it's leading to fears of a recession coming through. So the general, I suppose, the macro backdrop isn't great. Added to that, we have central bank policy at the moment globally is tightening. So we're seeing interest rates going up today. We have the Federal Reserve later on today. They're probably going to hike 75 basis points or even up to 1%. Tomorrow we've got the Bank of England. And all of this leads to other, macro headwinds, especially in Europe, where currencies like the US dollar is strengthening, the euro is weakening. So we're seeing things like when we're buying oil, we're buying that in dollars and we're buying it with euros, and the euro is weakening against the dollar. I think it's down below parity again today, which again is, these are global headwinds for everyone in the world and also for everyone in business, that these are costs that are going up that you can't control. And I think that's kind of the theme we've seen for the last few months and we're seeing for the rest of the year. And it's one of the big worries coming into the winter, that we're going to see costs continue to rise. And costs continue to rise, that central banks will also be putting up prices, so the cost of money is going to be rising, and nobody will have any easy way out of this because there's no easy fix. This is not a policy that someone is setting unless you're Vladimir Putin and the policy is to invade in our country. So the policy reaction is going to be very slow and perhaps not going to be very helpful.
And what does it mean? Talk to me about at farm level, at industry level, all of that environment that Lorcan is talking about, how is it translating, how is it impacting on our sector and what's likely to happen as well?
The biggest challenge across the board that's translating into increased input prices across the board for all businesses. I think, look, energy is the big story that's going to impact all businesses, and particularly we're talking about fertilizer in the farming sector. But fertilizer is only part of it. It's masking what's happening right across all of the other inputs. You know, we're lucky in one sense that prices are so strong, certainly in the developed world. And so that's supporting farmers and it's supporting that continuance of production. But the challenge has been coming, I suppose, undone for us globally, in the sense that, you know, generally high prices are a good cure for high prices in that they drive on production. But that fertilizer price is just starting to erode that production response in regions of the world like Africa, where, you know, the you have a local market for output prices, but a world market for input prices. And that's going to be a real challenge for us, feeding in. That kick and that response that we would hope to see isn't going to be there.
And in a previous life, you were obviously head of Agri for AIB. If you were to put your finance hat back on, what advice would you be giving now in today's world in terms of managing that risk and the financial risks that's out there?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, certainly when I've talked to all the banks recently, they're saying that farmers are in a very strong position. Certainly, like all businesses coming through the pandemic, deposits were very strong. I think you're starting to see that being eroded somewhat across the board. But current accounts are very strong, and overdraft utilization, again, talking to the banks, which is the measure that the banks use to see, you know, how much any customer is uptaking of the overdraft limits that are there. they're all very low. So that's the first thing to say. Farmers are coming
into
this very strong.
Are we in a bit of a, not a Walter Mitty world, are we in a sweet spot that a lot of our inputs were bought maybe at 2021 prices, commodity prices have risen, but looking ahead to 2023, do you see that continuing, that balance, or what Lorcan talks about, the full headwinds of a lot of these interest rate rises, currency volatility, input prices, how's that going to bear? How do you think that will bear on farmers' income in 2023 or the wider industry?
I think we're absolutely going to see it bite more into farmers' income than we have in the current year. Next year, we'll certainly see the inputs attacking more in. But the question is, what's going to happen on the output side? And in every other cycle, the expectation is that the high prices will drive production on and high prices will come back. And we saw that in 2007, 2008, we saw it in 11 and 12. The challenge in this, and fertilizer is a real challenge. Nitrogen prices are a real challenge now in actually getting that global supply response, that if you were talking from a developing nations perspective where food is becoming very unaffordable, it's going to be a positive to see prices coming back. And you'll see that burst of production. That's not coming through. So for farmers in Ireland, you know, what that does translate into is a continuance, an expectation that actually there's going to be a prolonging of those high prices because the supply response isn't coming through.
Because also then, and there's the environmental and policy issue that is driving production, actually either curtailing or driving production down in certain parts of the world. In terms of, we're seeing milk price version on a base of 60 cent a litre. Sorry for anybody who's at 58, but it's heading that direction. And let's call a spade, when milk price is that level, the balance between nitrogen maybe at 1,000 euros a tonne and whatnot is it can be managed. But the beef trade is very different, and I hate mentioning the B word because obviously that is, Brexit is another factor that's at play here in the background as well. Where do you see the outlook in terms of what Anne talks about, high prices curing high prices in terms of the beef markets?
Well, I suppose, Justin, we did have the experience of high prices coming out of the pandemic, you know, and it's ironic. Whenever in the first weeks of the pandemic, we were, I suppose, seriously concerned, maybe he's putting it too mildly, as to where this was going to lead us and where it was going to lead our industry. And it turned out, in fact, that it was an absolute blessing. It was an opportunity. People had disposable income and very few ways they could spend it, and it meant very good demand for beef, and in turn that came back into eventually good farm gate prices as well. Looking ahead now, I suppose the couple of things, like Lorcan talked, we talked about inflation there, and an example that would be of some concern to me, I was looking, and it's not maybe a company that those of us that are involved in the agri sector will have any great affinity with, but Beyond Meat, the company that produces the meat substitute product, like their share price is completely tanked. It has taken another hit in the last couple of weeks, and the big driver there was US food inflation prices at over 11%. And against that backdrop, a very discretionary spend on that product has meant that there's a serious pressure on that company. Now, in terms of red meat, beef, lamb in particular, they are the more luxury meats. And you can see how that if you're in a time of food inflation, then that will put a squeeze on there. But come back to the B word that I'm fed up talking about. You know, I used to think...
You made your career out of it.
Back in 2016, I thought to myself, you know, this is good. This is sort of a niche here that we'll get into. It'll come and it'll go. And now, six and a bit years later, I'm starting to feel it's going to be around the place as long as I am. But the reality is, from a farming point of view and indeed a processing point of view, it hasn't really impacted us yet. And that's simply because UK haven't enforced their full border controls. And secondly, we haven't yet had the impact of the trade deals that the UK have done. But those, Justin, are coming down the track and they'll be with us before the end of this year or at the very latest early next year.
Just for our audience, those trade deals that you refer to, Philip, where is that coming from?
Well, the first two major trade deals that the UK have done is with Australia and New Zealand. And basically what they have done, they have created an open market in the UK. They have essentially opened the doors completely to New Zealand. It's already been open for lamb, but it's now open for New Zealand beef, New Zealand dairy, and after a period of time, unlimited quantities. And Australia, who never really had access to the European market without heavy high tariffs, will have unlimited access as well for sheep meat and for beef. And if you take it Australia and New Zealand, the one and two, between them, they export 70% of the lamb that's traded in world markets. Australia is the number three beef exporter, up around 1 million tons a year. And they're also traditionally, along with New Zealand, one of the lower cost beef producers. Now, that hasn't been the way recently because of herd rebuilding. But the reality is, Irish beef, we have 80% of the imported market in the UK at the moment. Beef is the sector that's most exposed here. And it's something that over in 6 months' time, I'd be really concerned as to what impact that extra competition will have on us. Okay, we might have the geographic advantage, but the reality is the imported marketplace is about to become a whole lot more competitive than it has been up to now.
Phelim, one of the things, and we talk about it in this week's journal as well, that strategic partnership between Hilton Foods, who's obviously a major processor and packer for Tesco, doing that strategic alliance with Minerva in South America. Is that something you see? Anne talked about the pressure, and we hear the pressure even this morning on food prices and whatnot. Like, at what extent are retailers going to say, we need to get cheaper offerings onto our shelves? And obviously, you see South American product a lot cheaper. Is that going to be something that's going to be driven by food price inflation? Is it going to be driven by better market access and the ability of the UK to do its own deals? Like, how important is that? Or is that a trend that you see continuing?
Oh, look, absolutely. UK supermarkets at the minute, the top three, Tesco, Sainsbury and Asda, all have a policy of sourcing only British and Irish beef. The rest of the UK supermarkets, including the discounters, only source UK beef. But you can see in a time when consumers are under pressure, and you see like the discounters now, Aldi have climbed up to number four place in the UK at the most recent Kantar data there. And you can see that the squeeze will come on retailers to offer a value range, to offer a lower cost range. And if you want to get into that space, well, how else do you do it? The logical route to do that is to get into sourcing from South America, the cheapest producing area in the world for beef, and indeed in the case of Uruguay, sheep meat as well. So I think that's a possibility. If you were talking to them today, it's not part of their policy. It's not part of their strategy. But again, I would have a guess in a year's time, if we still have a high level of food inflation, then I would have a guess that that is an area that they will certainly look seriously at. And you know, you mentioned that partnership that's established there. The Hilton Group would be a long-established conduit into the Tesco Group. They're there for 30 years. And that's something I think you can watch out for, more of those partnerships. And again, if you're a meat processor in the UK, Justin, think about this and think of where we are in Ireland here in terms of the production constraints that we have in the context of beef and what our supply lines likely to be like. You know, there's no scarcity, and there's going to be no scarcity of supply coming from South America in the time ahead. So it makes sense if you're a processor to be looking at those channels as well. So those are all things that haven't affected farmers yet, but there are things that I feel are worth the farmers keeping their eye on in terms of developments over the next months and years.
Minister, I might just bring you in there, and thank you very much for coming down this morning. You could come to the plough in here and think everything is fine. Farmers are generally in a good mood. The weather's fine. Milk prices are strong. Beef prices are strong. But I suppose the guys are painting a few clouds on the horizon in terms of challenges. And there's always been challenges, let's face it, as well. But as Minister for Agriculture, I suppose, how do you see us navigating the industry through those challenges in the years ahead?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. And listen, it's good to be with you this morning and to see such a good turnout here. And indeed, congratulations to you and all the team for a wonderful stand as well. And indeed to the tremendous effort and time and preparation that's been put in by everybody who's exhibiting here to make this one of the pinnacle of the agri-food calendar. And it's great to be back as well and to be able to meet people. And you're right, I think in general, the mood is decent among farmers. Really importantly, we have seen price increases from, say, this time last year, and that has been crucial because of the real cost pressures that are there. And it was really, it's the first time in many, many years that we've actually seen food price inflation, because for many years we've seen general society costs going up, prices going up, but food prices have been static. And there needs to be an increasing recognition of the fact that primary producers, the role they play and the need for them to get a fair income is important, and that recognised. And I think when you look at the wider backdrop in relation to a growing world population, and also particularly because of the climate challenge, it becoming more challenging to produce food in many parts of the world, I think that role that food production and that value that's in food is increasingly being recognised. So I think as we go forward over the next decade, I think the future and the horizon is going to be an increasingly strong one for agriculture. And I think given our capacity to produce food and how well we do it, I think the next decade is going to be a strong one as well in terms of farm families and the food sector. And also, when you look at the capacity as well for additional funding for ecosystem services and energy in terms of additional farm incomes, there's potential there. But there's no doubt that there's real pressures in the short term, and we have to navigate our way through those. And in terms of the upcoming budget now next week, that's the key focus from the government across the economy, but particularly as well from my point of view in relation to the outcome for the agriculture.
Minister, I have a big blank front page at the minute. If you want to give us anything to fill that in relation to the budget, it would be very much appreciated. It's between ourselves in the room here. Give us some indication as to what's going to come in that budget for farmers.
Yeah, well, I presume the front page for the week after next is blank still,
too,
Justin. That's
a long way off, Minister. It's a long way off.
And if you...
Very good.
If you can't fill a paper on the back of a ploughing week, then there's no chance the rest of the year.
Don't worry, we'll fill
so
the
I
paper,
no doubt
Minister.
No doubt you'll manage that. But listen, obviously over the course of the last year, like I think it was a strong budget the last couple of years, but then we did respond over the course of this year in relation to the challenges post the invasion of Ukraine, particularly in relation to the fodder scheme and also the tillage scheme, which we're trying to address some of the key challenges in terms of fertiliser prices, in terms of the grain challenge, and then also in terms of the energy challenge. And I think, you know, coming out of the ploughing here now, we're going into the winter in a good position from a fodder point of view and from a grain point of view. So we want to look at next year in terms of the challenges there and in terms of the budget then seek to support farm families for next year. So I can assure everyone, while I can't give details, that is the focus in terms of working with the Minister for Public Expenditure. And
will we see evidence, Minister, of the cost inflation that farmers are facing and evidence of the government realisation of that in the budget?
You know, I think if you look at over the last year, there has been, in terms of how the government have worked to support the sector, that's been very much evident. And without a doubt, our entire focus now in terms of the budget is trying to support the sector over the course of the next year.
Minister, it would be amiss of me not to just, I suppose, one of the things, yes, there is a mood among farmers, but there is caution and concern around farmers' ability to continue to operate, not as they are, because farmers are prepared to change, but the constraints coming on their farm business, and that the policy direction at all sectors, whether it be nitrates directive, whether it be in the CAP reform, money moving from direct payments into eco schemes, everything is tailored towards forcing farmers to reduce the productivity of their farm. Do you accept that? And if you're looking at it from a farmer's lens, everything is about reduction schemes, more reductions in nitrates. Like, how do you square that circle of great opportunity with where all our policy is aligned to maybe forcing farmers to produce less?
No, I don't accept that at all. Our objective is about reducing emissions mm-hmm. over the next period of time. So, like, I mean, if you look at the schemes, a couple of schemes we put in this year, it was to support production. The tillage scheme, which has seen a 6 to 7% increase in the area under tillage, that's something we want to continue. The fodder scheme was very much about ensuring the activity levels were kept up and that we were productive at farm level. And now in terms of the next CAP and indeed in terms of how we meet the climate challenge, it's going to be about reducing our emissions. But really importantly, food production is going to be more valued and more important than ever, and we have to maintain that. And the key thing I'd say is, you know, with the research that's there and with the tools that is available to us now, we can be as productive, even more productive, but with lower emissions.
But Minister, I had a farmer in here yesterday. The nitrates derogation, the increase, the changes to the banding, the reduction of 220, he will have to go from 150 cows to 112 cows if both those measures, if the nitrates is reduced to 220. How do you tell him that he is not being forced to reduce production?
So there is a challenge there in relation to the nitrate side, and that is a challenge and a worry for some dairy farmers in particular, a minority of dairy farmers, but it is a real challenge. That's one that's not within our hands at national level because we're one of only two countries at European level now that have a nitrates derogation. which allows us to actually stock at a rate of 250 kilo nitrates per hectare, as opposed to the 170, which is standard across the EU. Now, we've fought hard to secure a continuation of that derogation. In doing that, we've had to introduce the banding as part of that. That is putting some pressure on a minority of dairy farms, but genuine and some medium to small
farms. But the 220 will have a wide ranging.
It's something we're very conscious of, and my objective as minister is to work to at European level to ensure we keep that derogation. But I accept that point and that particular challenge, and it's something I'm conscious of and will work to address. But across the board then, the objective over the next number of years is to maintain and improve production, but to reduce our emissions in the process. And we now have a range of tools available to us in terms of soil fertility, soil management, multi-species sward, clover incorporation, et cetera, which allows us to be even more productive in many farms than the case is at the moment, but with a lower emissions footprint as well.
Minister, are you going to hold on to the agricultural portfolio come the end of the year?
If you're interviewing the Taoiseach later on, you can ask him that question as well. Minister, you can give me a plug too if you want at the time, Justin.
I say that in good jest, and really appreciate you coming here this morning, and always as ever been open to the questions and the challenges and answering them. Tim Clannan, IFA President. Tim, I might just ask you to come in terms of the question I asked the Minister. Do you get the sense that policy direction and the direction of policy travel is to support farmers in production, or going in the opposite direction of actually trying to put pressure on farmers' freedom to farm, so to speak?
Absolutely, Justin, and it's a very important question. And look, we all know the direction of travel we're going is, particularly just dealing with the payments, first of all, you know, the payments are moving from compensating farmers for producing food to environmental measures. So this is a massive challenge for us. You know, and going forward, particularly in the productive sector, we're going to have to achieve more from the marketplace. And you know, I'd like to go back to Phelim and you know, the British market, you know, which has been critically important, you know, for Irish beef farmers for centuries. And I think it's an area that we do need to focus more on, and there's a huge challenge there for us. You know, we don't want to see a situation, Phelim, where our beef in the British market is going to be replaced by South American beef. And I agree with you, it's a massive challenge already. Boris Johnson has initiated two trade deals, and you know, the risk is going forward that they may do a trade deal with South America. But I think we have to find more opportunities. You know, we've seen you know, the transformation in the live export of beef animals up to Northern Ireland over the last number of years, you know, which is beneficial. But I think we need to go further. And you know, when I speak to my colleagues in the NFU, they would much prefer to see now Irish beef as number two on the retailer shelf in the UK rather than to see beef coming in from South America. And you know, this is something that we have been working on with our colleagues in the UK, in Northern Ireland, and I think we have an opportunity here. And I think, you know, the other area we need to look at is to add more value, you know, is genotyping and being able to, in particular around the suckler herd, to be able to premiumise that beef. And you know, even going back to the Brexit Adjustment Reserve, you know, it's about market diversification. I think, you know, this is the areas we need to look at now because, you know, and it's important that we're straight with farmers as well, Justin. You know, you're right, the money has shifted, and I don't think we're going to reverse that in the near future because, you know, whatever we're going to do, you know, we have to work around environment. And you know, we know now that we have a ceiling of a 25% reduction in emissions. I think, look, it's just as well that ceiling is there. We know we have to do massive amounts of challenges there, you know, and I think, you know, Chagas and ICBF, everybody is doing a lot of very beneficial work from a trial point of view at the moment, and, you know, hopefully we can get those trials into the system as we go. So I think, you know, we're going to need the science to work for us. I think a huge job of work to be done now to ensure that we can maintain that marketplace we have for our beef in the British market.
Okay. Stephen, I want to come into just to you now in terms of the minister mentioned it in his words in terms of energy production being a new opportunity for farmers in terms of an income stream. How confident are you that that's going to happen, and what do we need to see happen to make it happen?
Yeah, well, so thanks, Justin. I suppose we're in the midst of an energy crisis, the likes of which we've never seen before. Certainly, a lot of us have never seen before. And we still can't get it together. So last December, we would have had the announcement of the microgeneration support scheme, and this is a scheme that we had been waiting for years, and it was essentially going to incentivize the development of micro-scale renewable electricity generation, that being rooftop solar and possibly small-scale wind. The whole idea is that it would give enough of an incentive to get guys to put rooftop solar or solar PV installations on roof spaces, on sheds and whatnot, use as much as they could on farm, export the rest and get paid for it. That scheme's still not launched. Mm. It was supposed to be here by this stage and it's still not here. But even
why is that, Stephen? Why is it not here?
Well, I hope, Justin, the reason why it's not here is because they're revising it, because the scheme was developed before the energy crisis, mm-hmm. and you could argue that it's already not fit for purpose. So the way it works is that it's supposed to guarantee a payment of 13.5 cent per kilowatt hour for electricity exported to the grid for 15 years, which is great. You know, any kind of long-term security is useful from an investment point of view. But you can currently gain 20 cent per kilowatt hour from the market at the moment, albeit on maybe a 1 or 2 year term. So already it's too low, and you're looking at a payback period for a solar PV installation from a 20 cent per kilowatt hour payment versus a 13.5 cent per kilowatt hour. It's years of a difference.
Okay, Stephen, three things. The minister's still here. Yeah. What does the cabinet need to do to actually bring farmers into the renewable energy sector? If you were three things you were asked.
Well, where is he? Is he listening? Yeah.
Donegal man to Donegal man. We'll all close our ears.
No, we need a simplified, easy to access and easy to develop rooftop solar PV scheme specifically for farms. You know, it's limited to 50 kilowatt hours under the micro generation support scheme. I think we can do much better than that. I know that there's a small scale generation scheme coming up to 400 kilowatt hours, which might encourage the development of maybe small scale solar farms or so. Bring that forward as well. We don't need another consultation, so we need the scheme here and operational. And then on the other end of things as well, Justin, in terms of AD, the AD industry is developing. You know, it's already happening. So it is. There are plants. There are a dozen plants working their way through planning at the moment, and these are large-scale plants. So I think in the space of a few months, we're going to have a network of AD plants through planning and almost ready to go. Those who make it through planning, I should say. But these can't be developed without support. And we're not reinventing the wheel here. All we have to do is look to Europe to see how support schemes are operational. And it just so happens that We have the expertise in the country. In fact, some of the, I'll not say who they are, but there's some involved in the industry who have actually developed the AD schemes, which are in operation in Italy and in France and across Europe. So that's in-house. So we don't have to come up with anything new or groundbreaking. All we need is a 15 to 20 year support tariff of some kind and or capital grants. And that's it, and that'll be enough. And then the farmers, the industry will develop once that's in place. So that's the kind of support which we need announced next week. If you can pull that together by next week, Minister, it'd be great.
No pressure, Minister. I'm sure you're glad you came this morning. Michael, I'm sorry for the impromptu call out. Michael, from a Board BA perspective, what Phelim talked about, what Anne talked about in terms of the food price inflation, the Minister as well referred to it. Can you give us some insight into how you see the demand curve maybe going and what consumer reaction you see taking place to the higher prices?
If I can first address Phelim's point on the competitive threat. A lot of the solution to the competitive threat is in our own hands, because we have got a unique infrastructure here in Ireland in our sustainability schemes, in our ESDAS and EBLAS schemes that Sainsbury's, Tesco, all of those were in over the summer trying to get under the bonnet to see how they could deliver a similar process for English farmers. So we have got something that we need to build on and make distinctive, and that's how you compete with the Australians and others, because Sainsbury's have targets around their own greenhouse gas emissions, and we need to lean into that and help them deliver that solution through Irish beef and the premiumisation of that. There are headwinds around the prices of beef, particularly into the continent at the moment. We are concerned that consumers have less money because of energy prices, and that is a concern. What we're doing there is we're intensifying the promotion around prime cuts into our main retailers within the continent to actually create, enhance that demand with it. But there are headwinds, Justin, and you would be concerned about the price currently being paid for animals that are going to come to market early next year, because it's getting the consumer to pay the current prices to justify that is going to be a challenge. But we're out there actually pushing that, and it's really working with the right partners is really what it's about. You talked also about the competitive threat from that. Market access is crucial. If we have options other than Britain, we can actually negotiate better with Britain. So having options for more cuts in more markets gives us as an industry a better way of actually competing with Australia and others to deliver value back to farmers. So I think a lot of this solution is in our own hands and how we actually react to the competitive pressures out there.
Lorcan.
Yes.
As I say, I'm conscious you're looking at this sector new. You've heard lots of different stakeholders. You've heard your own colleagues talking about where the direction of travel is. You've obviously, in your previous role, looked much broader, but now you're looking at a sector that is seeing opportunity, seeing massive policy shifts, both in terms of at farm level and consumer level. What's your observations? What do you take out of this?
I think one of the things that's very important with policy everywhere is that everyone's on the same boat. Everyone's pulling in the same direction. And particularly with the environmental policy and the say, Board B's policy exporting high-value products, and there seems to be some kind of... not everyone's necessarily pulling in the same direction. We want fewer cattle, we want better cattle, we want higher production, we want lower production. And the kind of, if you ask me what the message for a farmer right now is, like I have a small beef farmer home, is I'm not quite sure. What am I supposed to do next? And I think what we're going to see in the next 6 months to a year is how consumers react is what's really critical. Consumers have less money in their pocket. They got used to, during the pandemic, having a lot of money because they're not to spend money on, so they bought high-value products. What we're seeing now is consumers are, they're back to community again, they're seeing the cost of petrol in their car, they're not saving so much money anymore, and also they're looking to save money where they can. And things where they can save money is high-value products they used to buy. They want to have a cheaper shop. Like their shop wants to be 100 euros a week and not 150 euros a week. So I think generally what we're seeing is we need to have policies in place that will counteract that in a way that everyone understands where we're going with it. And I'm not altogether sure that everyone understands where we're going next.
And I just want to come back to you and maybe touch back on the renewable side, because obviously there will be a level of capital required, and there's also going to be a huge level of capital required as Tim talked about getting to that 25%. It's going to take one of the greatest technology revolutions we've seen in our industry. And with that, let's be clear, comes great opportunity for a lot of people in this room, great opportunity for innovative farmers and whatnot. So we can't all be doom and gloom. But on the capital side of that and getting access to the necessary funding, how readily available do you think that's going to be? And I suppose we're in quite a good position in that our farms are relatively lowly geared at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't speak for the banks anymore. They're here and they can speak for themselves. But I certainly think...
No, we want the truth, Anne. Sorry,
well,
Owen.
Well, now, hang on, Justin. We always give you the truth. I think certainly in relation to renewables, solar rooftop, that type of thing, I mean, it's a very straightforward investment for a farmer and for a bank, because you have a pay down there, so it's very easy to finance. AD, I think, is a completely different ball game. I think there's an opportunity in AD in Ireland. I think it's, you know, it's not going to be necessarily at farm level, it's certainly where it is at farm level, my perception is it's going to be with intensive farms. It's a huge investment. And it's structured differently, and it brings a huge amount of risk that banks obviously will want a certain level of competence in. So I think they're two very different things in the renewable space. And I think in terms of the general opportunity, look, the banks have their own ESG goals. The sector has its goals. The regulators are looking at this. I think at some point, when farmers, and take a dairy farmer today going into the bank, I think at some point the scrutiny in terms of the environmental policy direction and how that plays out on your individual farm is going to become greater. I think it's happening already, but I think it's going to become greater. And the one thing everybody knows of banks is they like certainty. And they don't have that at the moment. And I mean, I met a number of dairy farmers this night and young dairy farmers, and you can't be but bowled over by their enthusiasm, the opportunity they see out there. And some of that opportunity is coming out of, you know, they're talking about, you know, 150, 200 cow herds who have no successor coming behind them and are a bit spooked about the environmental piece. And I see a huge opportunity there, and I'm not spooked about it at all. And that's a problem, because people have no sense of what to build their plan on, what to stress their projections on into the future. And if the sands are going to shift, I think that's going to become a challenge in banking as we move forward.
And it's something you and I have talked about before, and you highlighted it, the classification of farm loans from an environmental point of view. We saw Rabobank, and albeit at a very different debt level, and Dutch farms move to, I suppose, for a reclassification of loans. Where do you see the potential challenge? Because a lot of these businesses here are selling into farms. Farms probably need credit to buy the machines, the products and whatnot. Bank financing in relation to the green agenda, is that going to change? And could agriculture become almost, a prior is the wrong word, but almost seen as contrary to their ESG goals, lending to agriculture?
I don't think, certainly I don't think that they're, that in this country that we're in the space where they're going to differentiate agriculture between any other sector. But again, there's people from the bank here and they can speak for themselves. What has happened with Rabo is a very particular issue. They've moved their dairy loan book of 10.2 billion into vulnerable. And that's a huge move to make. But the language around that is so significant because they haven't talked about the risk to the sector. They've talked about the uncertainty and the lack of clarity about the government plan, and because it's regionalised, their lack of understanding as to how this impacts their book. And that's a risk. And I think, you know, the banks across all sectors, all loan books, have to move towards net zero ultimately. I think certainly some of the banks in Ireland have talked about agriculture moving to net zero by 2050. There's a horizon there. But they need to see that in the same way. They need to convince investors. They need to explain to regulators that this is how our sector stands up. So it's not just about, you know, it's about farming being able to give the confidence. And I think there's opportunities in farming. Farmers are going to have to invest, and the processing sector is going to have to invest in the green transition in all of their businesses. So they're going to have to show that journey as well, and there will be opportunities there.
Philem, you're throwing in the towel too easy on the British market. you're underselling the ability of our environmental and sustainability message to protect that market access.
Yeah, and I take the point, and take Michael's point there. The only thing I would caution there, and I'm going to finish in a positive, actually. Unfortunately, the minister's not here to hear it, but I'll be complimenting him as well. The reality is, you know, we have a great story to tell here, and our farmers do hit the heights in terms of performance, in terms of sustainability and all of that. But the reality is, Meat and Livestock Australia, Beef and Lamb New Zealand, if they were in the room today, they would be telling us a very powerful story about what they bring to the party as well with eating standards, etc. So everyone will make their push and their claim. However, there's one thing that we have, and we're at the advanced stage of completing at this stage, the PGI for our grass-fed beef on an island of Ireland basis. And this is where I would have to compliment the Minister, actually, and his northern...
Isn't it just a pity he's left?
It's just a pity he's left.
We'll text him. We'll text him on.
But no, they certainly... I think they've given political leadership there in the best possible way below the surface, and they have brought an application together on behalf of the island of Ireland that has avoided controversy at all points now. It has taken the scenic route together, and there were many mistakes along the way. But look, the bottom line is we're in the home straight now, and I think credit has to be given where it's due. And that will give the Board B a team something that will be a dedicated Irish brand to go forward to the UK market with, to go to everywhere with, that we can resource, that we can go out and hide. We don't have to avoid referencing what it is. So that is the positive, note that
I've got your positive. Guys, I'm going to take a quick 5 minutes if there's any questions from the floor. Anybody, Darren and Adam? Sorry, yeah.
Hello, Justin. Yeah. Just a couple of things there. There has been absolutely and utterly no mention of tillage here today. And tillage farming is vital in Ireland. The minister all right brought in the tillage incentive scheme, which did not suit the real tillage farmer. It only suited farmers for receding ground that got the money to put it into the silage pit. It didn't suit the real cereal grower. I put in 2 extra hectares this year, is all I could source in the thing, and the 2 hectares got refused because it wasn't put in 2022 or 2021. Also, to go to Tim Conlan on the IFA, they allowed in and they set a precedent this year on the allowing boer malt to charge an energy charge on the price of grain, which was absolutely and utterly scandalous. It opened the door for every industry that's buying our farmers to put it, a charge on them for processing their foods. It was up to boer malt. They're making enough. Like, rightly so, the Farmers' Journal brought out a great article a few weeks ago, and the farmer is only getting 1 cent of every pint. Boer malts, all them big companies, they all have plenty out of it. They didn't have to do that energy charge, especially this year when grain was going in at 11, 12% moisture. Never before did it happen. Also, on the boer beer thing there, it's the middleman who's making all the money out of the beef. You can see it when you see the rich list come out every year. It's the people in the middle who make the money.
Well, we're not going to certainly solve that problem.
Just had to mention
what they call it. Appreciate the comments. Anyone, anything, any other questions, comments? Zoe?
Thanks, Justin. I think it's really important in all this consideration that we remember that farmers are food producers. Mm-hmm. And the overall objective for Ireland is to demonstrate that we are producing affordable nutrition responsibly produced. And by affordable nutrition, that's not to suggest cheap, it's to remind the consumer and to retailers the package of nutrients that we are producing off a grass-based system. So I think it shouldn't be a race to the bottom in terms of price. It should be about building
product offering.
Mm. And in terms of the responsibly produced, I think we need to collectively have the proof points to back that up.
And we need science for that, Zoe. I presume saying we're the best isn't good enough anymore.
No, we need science. We need the audit data. We need the proof points to show the path of progress. And in doing that, we need to earn trust from both consumers and retailers that Ireland is on the right path. So affordable nutrition, responsibly produced, I see as a big opportunity.
Is anybody any tough questions for these four? Don't want to let them off the hook. Frank, a good man. Frank, now this is going to be good, guys. You better get ready. Sorry, Frank, I didn't actually see you. I was looking for you over there.
Got out of your line of sight.
You hit on me. That's what you did.
Way out of that now. No, I'd just like to ask Darcan, and first of all, thanks very much for a very interesting discussion there at the start of the session here. And obviously, you know, when we talk about input prices and currently being kind of compensated by product prices, but if the war in Ukraine ended, and I know there's no sight of that now, it's getting worse this morning even. But how quickly might we see gas prices and then fertilizer prices returning to something like normal? Because the danger with in a high price for both input and output is when the drop comes, if your input prices stay higher than your output prices, you could be really exposed. So how quickly might we see a drop once the situation settles?
First of all, the price of gas would drop immediately. That's it. But I think the problem we've had, because we've had high prices for 6 months, a year now, that the high prices kind of spread. Like, it's not just in gas, it's not just in fertilizer. You're seeing it crop up in everything. The food prices, the end product prices are rising. And if the end product prices are rising, the input prices will rise themselves because the price of labor will have to go up to compensate for people having to pay more for their shopping. So I think we'll see if the war in Ukraine ended tomorrow, which was the catalyst for a lot of the inflation we're seeing at the moment, prices would drop of the particular products, like of gas, of wheat. They drop immediately. But if you see, going to look at a widespread energy inflationary pressure we're seeing at the moment, that's going to take up a lot longer because the inflation has been there for 6 months now, and the pressure has been quite large for the last 6 months, and that's going to lead to inflation remaining high for a long time. And as we're seeing with central banks right now, they're pushing rates higher very quickly because they're starting to get really worried about second round effects, is what we call it. So wages go up, and that's what you really want to see. And we're starting to see that already.
But so, Lorcan, just on that, say Vladimir Putin, and as Frank says, given what we're hearing this morning, it doesn't look it's the other way it's going. But Russia's a pariah state now. Europe is not, like, we should have been commissioning Nord Stream 2, and gas should have been cut. Like, the war's not going to end, and they're just going to turn the tap on, and the gas is going to go back, and Europe is going. Like, have we learned any lessons from this, guys? Because if you look at it, we had a singular-focused energy policy in Europe to transition away from fossil-fueled energy production. It didn't encapsulate renewables, and all we did was suck fossil-fuel-based energy production from outside of Europe. And we're doing exactly the same with food. We're focused on a singular-focused territorial emission reduction target without understanding the mistakes that we've made in energy. Ursula von der Leyen came out and said that, and cascaded, and rightly so, President Putin for weaponizing energy. But Europe gave them the ammunition in terms of winding down its own. Are we not doing exactly the same with food production, on focusing on a territorial emission reduction target without any cognizance of the fact as to the impact that we're going to have on global food security and indeed European food security?
Well, I think one of the two big lessons we've learned from both the war in Ukraine and from the pandemic is that supply chains are critical around the world. And so, okay, right now you can say, well, you know, the supply chain of gas to Europe has been broken by the war in Europe. The war in Ukraine. But I think we're going to see kind of, if you're looking for us for a long-term trend response to this, is that we're going to see more national platforms. So if you want nationalization, not nationalization, but like, I suppose, energy sovereignty in countries, food sovereignty in countries. Countries are going to try to look like, in the US right now, one of the big things they're pushing for is to have chips, as in silicon chips, manufactured in the US. That's one of the big problems. So everyone's learning, oh, we're importing this stuff from across the world. It's cheap, but it's not safe because we're leaving ourselves exposed all the time. Mm. And if that's a lesson you're going to learn, then maybe we might learn as well that perhaps Australian beef and Brazilian beef might be the best place because, okay, it's cheap, but it's far away.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to wrap it up to let you get back to your stand. But before I do, I just want to thank you, each and every one of you, for your continued support and engagement, and wish you a great final 2 days at the Plough. From my own point of view, guys, this is probably the last time I speak to you, a lot of you, as editor. I've had 17 great years with the Farmers Journal, in a great industry, in a brilliant business with wonderful team, and it has been a great honour. We are hugely proud from that figure behind you. I'm always struck Garth Brooks only has to mobilise 400,000 people every 25 years. We have to mobilise 400,000 readers every week. And it's with huge pride that we do it, and it's because the reason why we do it is because of the team that's right across our business, and I'd just like to thank them for their support over the last 17 years. Cheers, guys. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.